Our next case for argument is Bond against Atkinson. Ms. Wittgren.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. Nadine Wickern on behalf of the State Defendant's Appellee from the Attorney General's Office. These appeals concern whether qualified immunity should have been granted to the state and county defendants on count two of Bond's complaint, which attempted to raise an equal protection claim against them. At the outset, I'd like to say, in light of the concession in Bond's brief, the state defendants stand on their brief for the point that no official capacity, policy, or practice claim should proceed here. In remanding, we ask this court to make clear to the district court that there is no claim of that nature in this case. This morning, my main focus will be on the first part of the qualified immunity analysis, which is whether Bond stated a plausible equal protection claim. Counsel for the county defendants will be discussing the second issue, whether qualified immunity was appropriate because the claim that she did plead was not clearly established at the relevant time. As to the first question, as this court is aware, the Supreme Court's decisions in Iqbal and Twombly require not only that the plaintiff provide notice of the claim to the defendant, but pleads sufficient factual matter to state a claim that's plausible on its face. To do that, the plaintiff must offer more than mere conclusions. And as this court's case is in McCauley and other cases make clear, the more complex claim that is raised, the more specific the allegations must be. And here Bonds raised an equal protection claim, which required her to allege that others who were similarly situated to her but outside of her class received the police protection that she claims to have been denied, and that she did not receive that protection because of the class she belonged to, which was female domestic violence victims. Also here...
So, suppose the complaint alleged that when men complain about abusive wives, the domestic violence laws are enforced, and when wives complain about abusive husbands, the laws are not enforced. Any doubt that that states a claim?
That would state a claim, and here there's no allegations that male victims of domestic violence or male victims of other crimes received more police protection than Bond. In fact, the allegations show that suggest that Bond did get responses to her calls to police, and that the state police were investigating the guns. So this is not a case where there's allegations that there was no police protection. It's just a matter of what she...
Look, you're not dealing with my question. My question has to do with differential police protection, right? If the allegation were that men are better protected when they are victims of domestic violence than women are, it's not a response to say that this plaintiff got some protection.
No, I agree, Your Honor.
One needs to do a comparison. Now, you apparently read the complaint as not alleging such a discrimination. And would you tell me why?
Well, there is no allegation of males, of other parties besides herself. The allegations focus solely on her interactions with the police. There's no allegations of male domestic violence victims, the kind of protection that they receive from the police. There's no allegations of what male victims of other crime, their experience with the police are. For example, in this court's recent Sung Park decision, the plaintiff there alleged that the students who were found to have cheated were not dismissed from the school, whereas she was for doing several things that were against the code of professional responsibility. At least there was an allegation of someone outside of her class that received different treatment. And even there, this court found the allegations to be insufficient because she didn't allege enough to suggest that those people were similarly situated to her.
Suppose the facts were contained in the affidavits that were supplied here, one of them by Detective, I think, Sheely or something, close to that is his name. Suppose those facts were in the complaint. Would that satisfy the requirements of the pleading requirements?
No, Your Honor. The facts that were alleged in those affidavits were statements that it was weird that the guns here weren't removed from the house because guns are removed all the time. That would suggest that there's perhaps a class of one kind of claim here, that guns are removed all the time except for in this particular instance involving Mrs. Bond. But the allegations weren't that. That seems right, that the guns weren't removed from her home, because the police never remove guns from homes at the request of female domestic violence victims. That's the kind of allegation that would have perhaps helped state a plausible claim in this case.
How about the house? This comment, the house is in his name, so we don't bother him.
I think you can read the allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and taking the reasonable inferences that maybe there was overly cautious police work, or police work that was too
Wasn't
slow
that
in investigating.
Differential as to sex?
No, it didn't say because he's the husband, but his name was also on the house, so you could understand why the police were investigating and perhaps taking
why
their time.
Why do you say if the house is in his name, that makes a difference? What's the difference?
Well, often when there's two people on the names of the house, if one person doesn't consent to allowing the police to come in, they might need to take some time to investigate to obtain a warrant if there's not exigent circumstances to enter the house. So I don't think that creates an inference of gender discrimination. And even if it did, it still would not be enough to state a plausible claim, given all the other allegations. This is unlike the case of Doe versus Calumet City that plaintiffs rely on, where there were several statements by the police that suggested that they would have perhaps helped her if she were not a female victim of domestic violence. In that case, there were a combination of statements that were suggested a plausible claim. But here, the idea that the police seize guns all the time does not suggest that they didn't do so here because of gender discrimination. The main problem with Bond's complaint is that she didn't allege...
Well, that was the excuse given here, is that they had to have a court order to seize guns, but there's some evidence that that was not really the enforceable rule, isn't it? I think in the affidavit about that's what they say, but that isn't the way it works.
Well, it would have been useful to have allegations of other circumstances where male victims of domestic violence or male victims of other crimes did have guns removed at their request without a court order.
You can finish Judge Cuddy's question.
I was going to pivot.
She obtained a protective order at this particular, that preceded this particular incident, right?
Yes, she had.
Why wasn't that pursued?
I don't know why it wasn't pursued.
I know you're the wrong person to ask.
Right. What we know about the state defendants is that she had contacted them and asked them to help remove the guns from the home, and they were.
Well, is that the procedure? What happened to the prosecuting attorney in all this? There was a protective order sought. She went into court and sought a protective order, which she received. As a part of a divorce petition?
That I'm not aware of.
This will be apparently right. For your opponent then to ask.
But I think this highlights part of the issue with what was alleged. When reading the complaint that focuses entirely on her interactions with the police, without providing allegations about another class, we have just a mere failure to protect claim, which is precluded by DeShaney. We ask that the court reverse. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad Elward.
Mr. Elward.
Yes, on behalf of the county defendants, I'm going to take just a couple of minutes here, Your Honors, and speak with respect to the issue of whether, assuming we have a right, was a right clearly established. And I know that puts me at kind of a difficult argument from the standpoint of the court's going to look at this complaint and decide what it believes the right was as alleged. And so I'm kind of arguing from the standpoint of as counsel said, we look at this as a case where they are saying that the right is to receive further police protection from private violence by her husband, namely by removing the guns without delay and by arresting the husband for gun violations. Now, what we're focusing on here is the clearly established aspect. And as the court knows, there's four general ways to do that: with a direct case, a closely analogous case, showing a clear trend in the law that establishes that this is a right that's just merely a question of time before it hatches, or the defendant's conduct was patently violative of the constitutional right, or I guess I would call that obvious. But in this case, we have a failure to show any of those or satisfy any of those elements. The Sarita case that we both cited in our briefs tells us that the constitutional right must be one that's specific to the relevant factual context of the case and not a generalized right with respect to the amendment that's the basis of the claim. Now, we acknowledge in our briefs, and so does the state, that the rights to equal protection, the rights to be free from gender discrimination, and the rights not to be denied equal protection, provision of police protection, those were clearly established rights in a general sense. What we're missing in this case, our position is, what we're missing in this case is something that ties us in to a policy of refusing to remove guns without a warrant. And we have been able to find no case that says that the failure of a police officer to remove guns from a home of a domestic violence victim, whether that's male or female, without a court order, rises to the level of a constitutional.
Does the complaint allege why Bond didn't just throw the guns away herself?
I don't recall that allegation.
A little puzzling, because given the order of protection, Bond had full control over the home. Whether the guns stayed there, you would expect, would be a choice Bond could make.
I think that she had those options available. Those are not before. They're not in the record as we have it today. What we think we're missing here is that there must be some case that relates a general gender-neutral policy of not removing guns from a home without a court order as violating equal protection because it's discriminatory. We don't have any case that makes that tie. Putting ourselves in the position of a police officer who's being asked to remove guns and is saying, I'm not going to remove those because we have a policy of not violating Fourth Amendment search and seizure without a warrant, that officer is in a predicament. There's nothing out there that says, in that situation, Mr. Officer, you have to decide this way. We don't have that here. And that's why we say it's not clearly established. Your Honors, I thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Elward. Mr. Hughes.
Paul Hughes for Plaintiff Appellee Stephanie Bond. We have 2 points, Your Honor. First, the provision of different and unequal protection of police services was a violation of Bond's constitutional rights. And second, that right.
Mr. Hughes, my big question in this case is whether the complaint is alleging disparate treatment or disparate impact. If it's alleging disparate impact, it's a dud under Washington against Davis and Personnel Administrator against Feeney, two controlling decisions of the Supreme Court that neither side cites, much to my puzzlement. If it's alleging disparate treatment, then it's a good claim. And which does it allege? That is, and I've asked Ms. Wichern what seems to me the concrete question. Does it allege that the police enforce the domestic violence laws when men are the complainants, but not when women are the complainants?
Yes,
that's
Your Honor.
Disparate treatment.
Our contention is this is a disparate treatment case. And the disparate.
So where does the complaint allege that the domestic violence laws are enforced when men are the victims, but not when women are the victims?
Your Honor, I'd point the court to paragraphs 235 and 236 of the complaint. And what those paragraphs explain is that domestic violence victims are provided less protection than other individuals.
No. But the complaint plainly alleges that the domestic violence laws are under-enforced relative to, say, the laws about bank robbery. But that's a disparate impact claim. That's the claim that since more victims of domestic violence are women than are men, under-enforcement of domestic violence laws has a disparate impact on women. That claim is squarely rejected by the Supreme Court's Feeney case, which, as I say, you don't cite. To have a disparate treatment claim, you have to say the state does not enforce domestic violence laws when women are the victims, but does when men are the victims. And does the complaint allege that?
Your Honor, if I may, I think that the law that we're alleging of lack of enforcement is not a domestic victim law whatsoever. It's instead the question of when police are told that an individual is possessing a large number of weapons, those weapons are illegally possessed because a FOID card has been revoked, what do the police do? Our allegation
Same question. Does the complaint allege that if women possess guns, the police will take them away without a court order, but if men possess guns, the police won't take them away?
Your Honor, I think that the fair implication of the complaint is that the police do not take the guns away when it is in the context of a female domestic violence victim.
But does it allege that they don't take them away when women have the guns?
Well, Your Honor, I think the inference of the complaint is that police, in circumstances that are not involving female domestic violence victims, would seize the guns in those contexts. If I could give an example.
Does it allege this? Now, look, one reason why I'm asking for concrete allegations is that there's still another case in the Supreme Court that neither side cites. That case is United States against Armstrong. The question in Armstrong is what kind of allegations are necessary to state a selective enforcement claim. Armstrong involved racially selective enforcement. You're claiming sex selection. Armstrong said the data have to be in the complaint or the request. You can't just file something and say, let's get discovery later. The Ninth Circuit said that in Armstrong, and the Supreme Court reversed 9-0. So this has got to be in the complaint. You can't just say, well, we'll look for it later.
Well, Your Honor, our analogous contention would be in the case of where an employer tells the police, I have an employee who has several guns in his car at the workplace. This is unsafe. Come seize him. Our factual allegation is police would seize in that context.
Look, there's nothing about sex there. If the police seize guns from cars and not from homes, that's not disparate treatment by sex.
Your Honor, our contention is
it might have a disparate impact, but we know from Washington and Feeney that disparate impact cases don't count under the 14th Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor. I think our contention is just that, though, that in any case that is not involving female victims of domestic violence, does not involve that sex criteria, there would be removal of guns, and that's where the disparate treatment.
Do you have any case, Armstrong requires detailed factual allegations. Do you have any allegation that Jones complained that his wife had guns and was threatening to use them, and the police seized the wife's guns?
Your Honor, we don't have a specific complaint to that effect, a specific allegation to that effect.
How you meet Armstrong?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is the fair implication of our complaint that
Armstrong rejected stuff about fair implications. It said you need not only anecdotes, but hard data, tables, numbers. Your complaint doesn't come within miles of Armstrong.
We are on a few points. Again, even without the disparate treatment or the invidious discrimination, there's also a claim for rational basis review. So at some point, this is a question of what our standard of review to the claim would be.
I don't understand what that would be if it's not a class of one claim. And of course, if this is a class of one claim, immunity is a cinch, right? In Del Marcel, we couldn't even agree on a majority opinion, right? For class of one claims in the context of law enforcement are the poster child of a place where the law is uncertain.
Your Honor, we've not claimed this as class of one claim to this extent. I mean, if the allegations later or the facts that develop were to show that, would certainly reserve the right at a later point. But as pleaded, it's not a class of one claim. It is an equal protection claim. But as the Ninth Circuit held in the Navarro case,
We're just talking by one another. The class of one claim in Del Marcel was an equal protection claim. Equal protection is the legal theory. You are either challenging the overall practice or you're challenging the specific treatment of your client. If it's the latter, we have a class of one claim. If it's the former, but it's not equal protection versus class of one. That's not the distinction.
Yes, Your Honor. No, the distinction I was making with the rational basis is it would be a protection of a particular class, but it would be the class of domestic violence victims or female domestic violence victims, absent proof of the invidious discrimination or the disparate treatment on the gender
category. That's exactly your problem. If you describe this as the class of domestic violence victims, which include both men and women, we're dealing with a disparate impact claim. Now, maybe I should just ask you, how could such a claim be reconciled with Feeney?
Well, Your Honor, I believe we have the two claims. We do not suggest that would trigger intermediate scrutiny standard, so we would not argue that if the claim is simply domestic violence victims, that would be reconcilable with Feeney.
It's not a case about levels of scrutiny. It's a case about whether disparate impact violates the Equal Protection Clause at all. The Supreme Court held no. Now, is your theory compatible with Feeney? That's my question.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I believe it's via our two separate theories. Our first theory, again, is looking at the class of female domestic violence victims and the differential treatment of that particular class is compatible with Feeney.
How?
Well, Your Honor, our contention, our allegation is in cases that are not involving female domestic violence victims. It could be in the case of male domestic violence victims. It could be other victims of crime. The police would take guns.
Standard disparate impact case. The class being discriminated against in Feeney was 99% female.
Well, Your Honor, in this first allegation, I'm defining the class as female victims of domestic violence. So the entire category of that class is female.
It just wouldn't help in Feeney. That's what the plaintiffs tried to do in Feeney, is define the class as the class of women who were injured by this particular law. The Supreme Court said the criteria of selection in Feeney, the question was a person a veteran, was not sex, but since most veterans are men, it had a disparate impact. Here, your contention is that the selection criteria, that is, domestic violence, has a disparate impact because most members of the protected class are female. That's just directly parallel to Feeney. That's why I'm asking you how your argument can be reconciled with it.
Well, so far,
you haven't persuaded me that you even have ever read Feeney.
The first, again, Your Honor, by defining the class as female victims,
Exactly. You wouldn't have done that if you had read Feeney.
Well, secondarily, Your Honor, is that I still believe we have the rational basis argument that
Feeney is not about levels of scrutiny. You are persuading me even more.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that if we have a defined class that the state treats disparately from a separate class, that, again, the Ninth Circuit in the Navarro case, the Tenth Circuit in the Watson case, have all said that does trigger equal protection analysis when a defined class is treated separately by the state and how the police respond to particular requests for assistance. And that still must be rationally related to a particular governmental interest.
Could you tell me about this protective order and how that plays into this?
Your Honor, yes. Plaintiff Bond did receive a protective order from the state courts following some of the incidents of abuse from Omoasagi. There was a protective order enforced during a particular substantial portion of this time that underscores that the police had the authority, if not the obligation, to remove weapons from the house. So it further, I believe, underscores the differential treatment.
Well, in Illinois, how do you seek to enforce a protective order?
Well, Your Honor, I believe you would ask the police to enforce the protective order. The protective order is written on
it. In other words,
it.
You just carried it into the police station and said, here's, I've got this order, enforce it?
Well, that something similar occurred, Your Honor, in this case where Stephanie Bond called the police and said, there's an order of protection, Omoasagi's violating it, you're seeking assistance. That direct enforcement of the protective order, though, is not the basis for our claim.
Well, I understand that. It's not the basis of your claim, but should it be?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would be a difficult claim to make in light of Town of Castle Rock decision, in that it's Your Honor, my understanding, not possible to enforce in federal court the terms of
the court. Well, I understand in federal court. I didn't say in federal court.
In other words, that
a judge already had jurisdiction over the very issues that you're raising right now, right?
Over Omosagi, certainly, Your Honor. The judge certainly had jurisdiction over the
including Omosagi. Removal of the guns.
Your Honor, removal of the guns was requested in the context of the order of protection. Plaintiff Bond wrote expressly in asking for all of the guns to be removed.
Was she represented by counsel on this?
No, Your Honor. I believe that was a pro se application to the court.
For a protective order?
Yes, Your Honor.
Already pending domestic relations?
Your Honor, I believe the context was it shortly followed an arrest of Omosagi on domestic violence charges.
But there was no other. She just went in and sought a protective order?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe following the arrest, she sought a protective order to receive court assistance.
But my point is, and I'm not sure exactly how this plays out, but a court had jurisdiction over the very issues that you're raising in federal court. A state court did.
Your Honor, the state court had jurisdiction over an order that was compelled Omosagi to stay away from Stephanie Bond.
And for the police to remove, or at least somebody to remove the weapons.
Your Honor, the court did not order removal of weapons as part of its protection order. Plaintiff Bond requested the court to ask the police to do so. The court did not do so. So
there was not included in the order.
Yes, Your Honor. There was no state order to remove these weapons that was included in the protective order, despite having been asked for that.
But that case was still pending.
It was still pending, Your Honor, and this was brought to the attention of the police when she was requesting assistance, noting that there was a protective order and asking the police to enforce the protective order. Again, that doesn't form the basis of a federal claim. There are pending state claims, though, that certainly will be relevant to. I'd like to just address briefly the qualified immunity analysis. I think it's important to note that the county defendants have contended that the qualified immunity analysis requires prior case law showing that there was an affirmative obligation to remove guns in this context. And that's just not the legal right that we're asserting. We're not asserting there was a federal right requiring police to remove weapons. But instead, the legal right that we assert is the right that Stephanie Bond be treated as a female victim of domestic violence, equivalent to others in similarly situated classes. So the question of whether or not police do or do not remove weapons in that context is, for purposes of this analysis, a factual question. It is, again, as I said earlier, when an employer requests removal, when a male victim of domestic violence requires removal, what do police do in those circumstances? Which, as we allege, is a question of fact, and we believe that will be shown that police do, in fact, remove guns in these closely analogous circumstances. Furthermore, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Elward?
No, I give for my time.
Your time's expired, Ms. Wichern. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our third case of the